So continuing Canto 7, Chapter 12, and then Text 7. A brahmachari, or one who has not accepted the grihastha ashram, family life, must rigidly avoid talking with women or about women, for the senses are so powerful that they may agitate even the mind of a sannyasi, a member of the renounced order of life. Purport. Brahmacharya essentially means the vow not to marry, but to observe strict celibacy, brihadbrata. A brahmacharya sannyasi should avoid talking with women or reading literature concerning talks between man and woman. The injunction restricting association with women is the basic principle of spiritual life. Associating or talking with women is never advised in any of the Vedic literatures. The entire Vedic system teaches one to avoid sex life so that one may gradually progress from brahmacharya to grihastha, from grihastha to vanaprastha, and from vanaprastha to sannyas, and thus give up material enjoyment, which is the original cause of bondage in this material world. The word brihadvrata refers to one who has decided not to marry, or in other words, not to indulge in sex life throughout his entire life. So this principle the Vedic system is this point, is to give up, is the whole idea is trying to give up material enjoyment, because that is the original cause of being in the material world. We come into the world because we have decided that we want to be the enjoyer. So this then manifests in the desire to lord it over the material energy. So then sense gratification means that one is engaging the senses, you know, for one's own enjoyment. And so that then becomes, that is to be avoided. So the whole idea is that there must be this proper control here. So then, other than particular service that is there, or, you know, for the brahmachari, then there's no real need of discussion. And for the grihastha, then, you know, those activities in the household, taking care of that, discussing this and that, then that is the standard conversations and activities. But sense gratification is always to be avoided. One is planning to have child, then sex life will be there, but otherwise one will avoid, because otherwise it just leads to bondage, because the whole process is that when one's engaging in Krishna's service, then there's so much planning ahead of time, so much activity is being done, planning is there, and by that planning, then all aspects become engaged in Krishna's service, so then there's no sense gratification. But if there's no planning and there's no specific purpose, then that's when it becomes sense gratification. Because then the whole consciousness goes on to the senses rather than on the service to Krishna. So the grihastha, even though he may have children, then the idea is that they're not interested in the sense gratification aspect. That comes just like someone who knows properly. They eat on a regular, festivals another thing, but regular day eating, then one is eating to maintain the health. So in that maintenance of the health, we see that also the taste is taken care of. Means that what one's eating has some taste, there's some flavor there. But that's secondary to the purpose of trying to maintain the proper health. So in the same way is that in the performance of the household duties, then the predominant aspect is the performance of these activities for the pleasure of the Lord. And then besides that, then the senses will also be taken care of. That just happens automatically. So here then the brahmachari who has not accepted the grihastha ashram has to very rigidly not engage in anything that will be connected in this way, avoid talking with women or about women, because otherwise there's no benefit for them in the service. There's no proper need. So then by doing this, then the senses may become disturbed. So the whole idea of the Brahmacharya ashram is that the senses are being controlled for a time long enough that one gets accustomed or practiced to controlling the senses. Then when the senses are thus controlled, and one is able to deal with them and control them in that way, then one finds that everything goes very, very nicely. But if one doesn't control the senses, then we find that when one enters into the Grihastha ashram, then there's a big problem. Because then one will just be very carried away by what's there, and in mode of passion always ends in distress. So it may seem nice in the beginning, but then it turns out not so nice a little bit later. So the whole idea is, as Prabhupada mentions here, the entire Vedic system teaches one to avoid sex life so that one may gradually progress from brahmacharya to grihastha, grihastha to vanaprastha, and from vanaprastha to sannyas. So the brahmacharya to grihastha, from the grihastha to vanaprastha, is only going to happen if the attachment to sex life is not there. So unless it's been engaged properly, only then that whole desire can be purified. Because if it's not, if that purification doesn't come, then one can't give up the attachment, and one can't move into the vanaprastha ashram. And then it makes it just, you know, a little bit more difficult to progress in spiritual life. Because the whole idea is that all grihasthas should be moving to the vanaprastha stage. Vanaprastha basically means one gives up the desire to have more children and to increase the, how you say, material facility. You maintain what is necessary for taking care of what you have, what children are there, what facilities are there, but one is not trying to exponentially increase that more and more and more. That is being avoided. So that is the idea. But otherwise, it won't happen. So that practice has to be there. That is the point. Now, it's not that there's not something higher being offered. The transcendental flavor that's there, the transcendental understanding, the transcendental taste, is way beyond the taste of the material senses, like that. But that takes faith, that takes practice, takes good association. Then one can understand that. Then it becomes much, much more easy. So at least in the beginning, the brahmachari, out of his intelligence, should give it up, even if he wants to get married, just to know that otherwise the marriage life will not go properly. Just won't happen properly. So that must be given up. But then here it mentions the brihadvrata that he talks about. It means giving up for the whole rest of the entire life. That means there must be a higher taste. You can only give up the lower when there's the higher. You can give up engaging in a lower taste if you know that it'll be put off till later. Like if I tell you, okay, you can eat now and I got some muri in that here, or you can wait for 2 hours and then there'll be a nice feast and so many nice things. Right? So then one can put off for some time if one knows that there's something later. So the brahmachari, any brahmachari should be able to properly establish a time of following the vrata of brahmacharya and follow it for that amount of time. Then they may get married. So on that principle is that the mind can be made peaceful for a particular amount of time so that one can be trained. That can be done. That is done. Right? So that means any brahmachari then we'll say, okay, for this amount of time, we're not engaging in any sense gratification. And then after this time, then we'll get married. Because if we don't, then we won't be able to properly control the senses and be trained to become good grihasthas. It just won't happen. Text 8. If the wife of the spiritual master is young, a young brahmachari should not allow her to care for his hair, massage his body with oil, or bathe him with affection like a mother. Purport. The relationship between the student or disciple and the wife of the spiritual master or teacher is like that between son and mother. A mother sometimes cares for a son by combing his hair, massaging his body with oil, or bathing him. Similarly, the wife of the teacher is also a mother, Guru Patni, and therefore she may also care for the disciple in a motherly way. If the wife of the teacher is a young woman, however, a young brahmachari should not allow such a mother to touch him. This is strictly prohibited. There are seven kinds of mothers. Atma Mata Guru Patni Brahmani Raja Patnika Denur Dhatri Tata Prithvi Saptaita Mataras Maraha. These mothers are the original mother, the wife of the teacher or spiritual master, the wife of a brahmana, the king's wife, the cow, the nurse, and the earth. Unnecessary association with women, even with one's mother, sister, or daughter, is strictly prohibited. This is human civilization. A civilization that allows men to mix unrestrictedly with women is an animal civilization. In Kali Yuga, people are extremely liberal, but mixing with women and talking with them as equals actually constitutes an uncivilized way of life. So if the brahmachari is, and this means if he's very, very young, that's another thing. But if he is, in other words, she is, he may be older and she may be younger, or, you know, or the age is not very much different between them. And he is of an age where he actually understands the whole relationship between man and woman. Then at that time, then he shouldn't allow the young wife of the teacher to touch him like that. Because naturally, out of motherly affection, she wants to care and do these things, but he just won't allow. He generally even won't even touch her feet anymore. Before that, he may, if he's younger or that, but if the age difference is not very great and he's within the realm of understanding, then even that he shouldn't do. Like that. Mentions that in the Manasamhita. If they're younger, or the wife of the teacher is very old, much older, so there's, you know, significant difference like that, then that's one thing. But generally, once he becomes of age, especially in the late teens, you know, mid-late teens, then that's avoided. Now that's, of course, we're talking about very nice Vedic. Nowadays, probably from, you know, once they hit, you know, 12, then this should be avoided. Because nowadays they know too much, too early. Well, before they knew very little, even late. It was funny, the Ayurvedic doctor who took care of Prabhupada, he was telling us, it was, you know, a funny story, is that his father had arranged, he'd been married, and he was living with his wife. And they were running around together, they were best of friends, going here, there, and talking, and laughing, and joking, and this and that. So this went on for some time. Then the father decided, okay, called him over and says, hey, listen, this is your wife. You know, the relationship's a little bit different like that. Because they were so ignorant of thing and so well trained, you know, because they wouldn't sleep together, wouldn't stay in the same room. So she dressed her place, him in hers place, this and that. They didn't really understand the whole biological function between man and woman. They just didn't know what was going on. So then the father kind of had to let him in on, you know, some of the details, and then, you know, then they understood and were a little bit more careful. Otherwise, they're just saying like they were a bunch of kids, you know, a couple of 8-year-olds running around having a good time or something. So that's the in the Vedic thing. So someone could be easily into their late teens, early 20s, and not really understand what's going on. You know, so this is the example here. The Ayurvedic doctor, he had been married, and he didn't know what was going on. So it mentions that's important. The Manasamhita says if the child understands what's going on, and the wife of the teacher is young, then she won't touch him, he won't touch her. But if he's below that age of understanding and she's not young, then it's no problem. Well, generally in this, it wouldn't be, I mean, in the Gurukul, it wouldn't be done. Because she would be the the teacher would be teaching and his wife would be, you know, taking care of the ashram and doing all the different aspects around the house. That's what's going on in this, in the typical. Because you have the husband and wife, he teaches and she takes care of everything else. And then the students, then they do things that are kind of like outside the house. They don't do so much in the house. They would like take care of the lands, the cows, go out begging, go out into the forest, bring the firewood, bring the fruits, the flowers for the yagyas, you know, milk the cow. They would do that kind of stuff, like that. And inside the house, because you're talking about a teacher with a few students, generally the recommended was not beyond 12, you know, for a single teacher, like that. Though if they knew how to organize things nicely, they could keep hundreds of thousands. You know, like we see with Durvasa or Vishishta, like that, they'd have 10,000. But they didn't have 10,000 all at once. They taught the first group, and then when they matured, they remained naistikas, so they didn't graduate. And then when the next batch comes, then the teacher would teach, and then these ones would help. And then as another batch comes, then you can start having so many levels happening. Generally what happens, the main philosophy classes, and the Veda that the teacher teaches, and all the other angas and all that, then the others that will help with. But the normal thing is in the system is that this is in the house. Then when you'd have bigger, then you have others teaching. When you have more like a charana or like that, where you have a head teacher, and then you have so many other teachers under, it's more organized in that way. It's not like a house school. It carries the same flavor. The Gurukul means there's a particular flavor that's always there, that of the intimacy of dealings of the home. But it will change in that you will have many teachers and many students, like that. So it's either those teachers are assisting the main teacher, or the students are the students of those teachers, but those teachers work under the kind of mood and direction of the main teacher, like that. So in that case, then it would be, if you come into the more modern scenario, or even the Vedic, is that the arts, you know, definitely could be learned from the ladies. The, you know, which would include your language arts, or, you know, your different fine arts, all these things that are generally there. Then our histories, they could also be. Main thing that wasn't learned, the women wouldn't teach, would be the Vedic verses themselves. You know, means not the Smriti, you know, like Gita or Bhagavatam, but the Vedic verses themselves, actually the Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva, those verses. And the main philosophy, you know, the main transcendental philosophical courses. They generally wouldn't teach those, but other things, if they taught, wouldn't be a problem. Like that. I mean, it's the top levels. Basic levels, that's going on anyway. I mean, the mother is the first guru, so she naturally teaches in the character and culture, philosophy, etiquette, all these things she's teaching. But the very technical aspects, generally, then wouldn't be taught by the ladies. You know, I mean, to the boys, they would teach them. They can teach them to the girls, but they wouldn't teach them to the boys. Does that make any sense? Like that. But otherwise, in the house, you don't see that they would teach at all. In the ancient, because they didn't have to. They would learn the Vedic verses, and then for a part of the year, and revise those, and then study the philosophy in connection with those. That would be for about 5 months of the year. And then for 7 months of the year, then they would learn, you know, Sanskrit and, you know, astrology and all these other branches. Like that. That would be go on the other part of the year. So they would go like that. The year would be divided into two terms. Basically from around July to January would be one term, because that's when you just see weather-wise and everything, the mind is very fixed. Like that. It means during the rainy season, the mind is very sober, and up to the before spring, you know, Vasant Panchami, that's the end. Where Saraswati Puja and all that is, that's the end of the Vedic term. It means that the Vedic, learning the Vedic mantras. Then from there, that time in January, up until whenever it is in July, August, whenever the Titi is established, then that would be for all the other literatures. Like that, all the supporting literatures, all the Vedangas. Like that, your Sanskrit, your astrology, your ritual, you know, like that, that would all be heard, studied seriously at that time. The literature is more vast, so it's given a little bit more time. But because of its lighter nature and its so much difference, then those, the spring and summer and first part of the rainy season, then it does very nicely, it interests. Well, then when the mind becomes more sober in the latter part of the rainy season in the fall and winter, then it's much easier to memorize and deal with the meanings of the Vedic literatures. Does that make any sense? So that would be the tradition. Because you see, it's in the summer, the students get more restless, they're more into games, like that. So that's a very good time for arts, variety, you know, and kind of like little technical things, you know, how to do a little this and that, and all that kind of stuff. It gives more interest because there's variety is happening very quickly, and so many varieties of subjects. While in the other time there wasn't so much variety of subjects, they concentrate specifically on the main philosophy and other and memorization of the Vedic text. So the only time I've heard of that, then there was any involvement in that was once, I think it was Vishishta, had gone for some big yagya like that and didn't come back when he was supposed to. And so then the students got worried, and how are they going to learn their, you know, the next group of mantras, and, you know, in the proper time and all that, Vishishta doesn't come. So then, you know, they were, and the wife of the teacher is always very kind. You know, sometimes when teacher's being very strict, then the wife will come and say, you know, okay, it's enough, you know, like this. So then she thought about it and thought, okay, this is, you know, valid point. So she went and got Vishishta's kamandalu and took some water from it and sprinkled it on the students. Then they immediately just started chanting the verses from the next chapter, you know, like that. It's just immediately memorized, like that. So then I think just after that, then Vashishta came and he heard them chanting, you know, chanting very nicely, and he's thinking, what's going on? They're chanting the next chapter. I didn't teach him that. So he's thinking, who has come and taught? So he was very upset because, you know, while he's away doing a yogi, you don't come and teach his students, like that. So he came in and he asked the wife about it. And she says, I just sprinkled some water from your kamandalu. And then they started chanting. So that's the only time I've heard of that thing. So then they can chant the mantras as long as they can take a little water from the kamandalu and sprinkle it. And it would be a pretty good way of teaching, wouldn't it? Yeah. That would be pretty good. You know. Come in, okay. This semester's, you know, with a creative writing and all that, and you sprinkle the water, and then they start writing, you know, Shakespeare and everything like that. And be good. But. Yes.
You mentioned more of the differences of the mind working in different seasons.
A little louder.
Can that be applied to something else also, or just learning? I mean, some type of other activity, like, I don't know which can be parallel to maybe creating or starting construction or starting something new during that time or then finishing in the other time.
Well, generally you see all your festivals and all your main, like, you know, weddings and anything new and all that, you generally is happening in the Uttarayana, when the sun's moving towards the north. You know, that'll be basically January to, what is it, January to February, March, April, May, June, July, up to July. And then when the sun moves the other way, towards the south, then that's more for more contemplative. In other words, subjects that need more contemplation, they're deeper in that way. Those, that's a very good time for that. You know, just like you have see, in India, you'd have the rainy season. The rainy season, people didn't move around much because the roads were mud. And so then other seasons, it's very easy to move. In rainy season, it's not very easy to move on. So rather than do something very difficult, they would just stick they would just stick to one place and study. So then that's a very nice time to just get down and do all kinds of study. So if you have a difficulty in organizing, you know, a very nice study program for all the devotees, then those times, you know, from it, that you can do so much activity outside and all that, that's done. And then those times when not, then that's a very good time for study programs and that. Like when you're snowed in the winter, then you can have, you know, so many nice seminars, study programs and different things. Devotees should really get into reading and chanting and nice kirtan and, you know, then you get out all the dried cabbage and, you know, like this, yeah, have a good time. That's mainly what the idea is. Just like the sannyasis, they would travel for 8 months, and then 4 months they just sit down and study. Like that. So in this way, then you kind of like, it balances things. So it's interesting, is that the heavy subjects would be learned at that time, like the Vedic mantras and the philosophy. And then the lighter subjects, you know, such as, you know, all the Sanskrit grammar, astrology, astronomy, and, you know, all the rituals, which devotees will consider very heavy subjects. Those are considered the light subjects, you know, like that. And then, you know, and then at lighter times of the day, they would use arts. Or after they finished the Vedic, then they would study arts, like that. That's one recommendation. After you finish your philosophy, your Sanskrit, your astrology, your ritual, you know, and all your other main subjects, you know, your Dharma Shastras and the histories and all that, then you can concentrate on arts, like that. Is a thing. So the idea was especially the Brahmin should get down all the important aspects first, then he can go into those sites very much. Otherwise, then the lighter part of the day means basically the late morning and early afternoon, those are all like for time, good time for arts, you know. In other words, your more serious subjects would happen at other times, and then the late morning and early afternoon, that would all be for whatever's your lightest subjects. Then, so that way you have your light and heavy in the day. Then in the, for the year, then you would have your lighter subjects, you know, January through July, and your heavy ones from July January, like that. At least that's for, you know, above the tropics. When you go down under, I'm not sure what happens there, because all the astrological signs are still in the normal position, though the seasons are backwards. You know, so the time when you should be serious and all that, that's when they're all out at Bondi Beach doing surfing, you know. So it must be a little strange on the head down there. Because no? It's like, huh? What's that? Oh, I guess up there, yeah. But if you're down in Melbourne, then that's another thing. Or Melbourne or Adelaide. Then I guess life is more sober.
The split of the day is what you just mentioned.
Means very early morning, that's all your spiritual. Then a little bit later in the morning, then that's all your like heavy academic. And then this late morning, then it'll get into your more lighter subjects, your arts and like that. Then the early afternoon, and that also, that's good stories and, you know, the arts and fine arts and stuff like that. Then the evening again, it starts to become good for for your more heavy subjects, but generally you wouldn't use it for like normal academic. You'd use it for like spiritual kind of things like that, or some kind of connection like that. But again, you can hear. But that will generally be your evening will be more oral classes, like that. While the morning will be anything that has written work, that kind of thing. You know, memorization, anything that like very heavily uses the mind and intelligence. While the evening is more for philosophy, conclusions, contemplation, like that. That will be how your day will go.
It's very similar to what we heard the kings should do.
Yeah, that's why the king does it that way. The Brahmins also, is that they'll spiritual life in the morning, then they teach, then there's lunch, then in the afternoon there's the light things, and at that time they teach day students or arts or different things like that. And then after that, then in the early evening, that's when they deal with all the, you know, material day-to-day life, you know, like that, any business, anything that's done in the afternoon. And then as it goes into the evening, you know, then they get back into the philosophy and like that kind of thing. Philosophy discussions like that, you know, that would be. You had something, Pima?
As you were saying in the purport, this unrestrained mixing is like symptomatic of uncivilized society. So then, with boys and girls, the natural tendency of all young children is to play.
Mm.
So at what age does that kind of cut off? What's the cutoff age for that with boys and girls? And what are the implications of that?
Not there. Well, the general thing is girls past 7, they don't let the boys touch them. Like that. Even the father won't. They'll be more careful. But it's mainly, you know, all the, you know, neighborhood friends and all that. And that, they're just after 7, the girls, they just, on their own, they just don't let them touch. And they'll tell them, you know, I'm 7 now. I'm, you know, big. You don't touch me. So they, you know, they talk this and that, that kind of thing, but they don't touch. And then once they hit 11, like that, past then even the father doesn't touch them, like that. Other, you know, pat on the head or like that. But otherwise, even he doesn't deal so much like that. And so the earlier is just they get so used to, it becomes habit. The whole idea is that whatever you want to happen, you know, at puberty, that already has to be practiced many, many, many years before, so it's already habit. So it's like the habit has become perfected by 10 years of age, because generally 10 is like the pure devotee age. Is 10, they do everything nice, they relate with adults very, very nicely, they can also deal very nicely with the younger kids, you know, and they respect those older. It's a very, it's like you're, it's like of the very young, of the, it's the nicest age. So by that time it has to be habit, they have to understand, they have to be already relating properly with the adults and you know, senior members of whoever it is that they're dealing with very nicely. Then when they hit 11, then a whole new, how you say, kind of like areas of understanding open up. So all these other kind of like other things have to have already been practiced. It's just second nature by that time. If it's not, then it's very hard to deal with creating new habits and having this new understanding all at once. It's like too bewildering. So it means all the things that you want of proper behavior to be there, you know, the gentleness and all the different kinds of ways of behaving and dealing with people and dressing and all that should already be done by that time. Because in the Vedic tradition, at 11, a girl could hold down a household. I mean, she was mature enough, she could actually run a house. I mean, you don't have 50 million screaming kids at 11, but she could, you know, by the time she has, she'll be quite experienced. So it's just, that's why girls mature so much faster than boys. So boys are in a different category. They're you know, 6 to 10 years behind the girls in maturing, like that. So it's one has to be very careful to see that that's all done at that time. main problem is if the, when they're young, at that time one doesn't see the problem. But it's just like, let's say, I remember my father telling me that you have a car. And I was wondering why he keeps taking it into the shop and checking it. Nothing's wrong. He is saying that if you regularly take it in, then nothing will be wrong. Because something a little bit is there, you can catch it before it happens. But if you wait until something goes wrong, that wrong creates other wrongs, and then you can, you know, almost total your car once something happens. Because there's so many problems then going on. And the damage is much greater. So the whole idea is that before puberty is reached, all these habits have to be put in. So even though you don't see the problems then, that's when they have to be, the subtleties of them have to already be dealt with and corrected. You know, any roughness in the child's nature should be ideally worked out before they hit ideally before 11, because 11 they have a tendency to can get a little cheeky, like that. That's the age of cheeky. That many times, that's a very bewildering point for the parents, especially the mother. Not so much for the father, but for the mother. Is that the kid was so wonderful at 10, and you just seen him over the years, just the budding of the consciousness and coming up and starting to follow and be responsible, and then it just goes up to 10, and then you just figure 11 will be better, and just it'll just keep going, but suddenly everything turns upside down at that time. So the how do you say? You know. So especially you'll see, like with boys, is that they were so nice and chanting so many rounds at 10, and they hit 11 and they just become monsters, you know. Let's say, before that they were pleasant blobs, right? And now they become monsters, right? Still blobs, but monsters, you know. So that's very bewildering for the mothers. That's why the tradition is the boys would be in the Gurukul also at a young age, because the teacher has to be able to work on that so when they hit puberty. Because otherwise, if they stay at home, it looks great through 10, and then when they hit 11, it starts to go, and the parents can't figure out something's wrong here. And they figure it'll go away, because, you know, it was always getting better. But then when they hit 12, then they see it's getting serious. And by 13, then it's just, they can't handle them anymore. They're just so crazy and wild, they can't handle them. So then it's time for a little discipline and off to the Gurukul and all that. But then by that time, the teacher can't do anything either. You know, you've already run the car off a cliff, you know, and then you bring it into the mechanic. Can you just have a little tune-up here? You know, it's like, it's like time to sell it for scrap. And they figure, oh, you just a little tuning, you know. But so that's the tradition.
So it might seem at an age where parents should, if they have the knowledge, then be pulling the child in closer. It seems to be an age where most parents are just letting him go.
Yeah. No.
And then they try when the kid starts cutting up really rough.
No, it's got to be the opposite. The whole idea is that you pull them in when they're gentle, and then you let them out when they get wild, like that. So it's just the opposite of what generally any modern New Age. Well, New Age, they let them be wild all the time. But how most parents is when they're real gentle and young and innocent, they just let them be crazy. And then when they go, you know, clinically crazy, then the parents freak out and then just tighten up so much. But you can't do that. That's why all these things have to be habit. Because a teenager is going to be crazy. So now if proper behavior, etiquette, sadhana, work ethics, you know, cleanliness, and all these different things are already habit for them, then all they have to do is deal with the craziness of their mind. You don't have to deal with the craziness of behavior. You know, they're just a little bit more spunky. So then it's just they move into more serious subject matters. They're now mature enough you can take them places and do things with them. You know, it's like then, at that time, that's also then when the man's relationship starts to become strong, because then the individuality starts to come out very much, and then the man now can start to relate a little bit better. You know, like that. And then, but for the mother, it gets a little weird to relate at that time. They can't figure out what's going on. It's only kind of like when they come out of that in their late teens and early 20s, then they become, mother can recognize, you know, here's their son again. Otherwise, in between, it's kind of like they're not quite sure what it is. It looks like their son, but it somehow or another doesn't fit into the idea of what they had as the, you know, how their son would behave, you know. So it's one has to see, you know. So those things are very, it's very important that that's all gotten in. And training starts early, you know. Training starts early.
Samaraj, when you say...
Early means, you know, serious training can start, you know, around 2-3.
At the stage where you pull them in now and it's have it there and they start getting to that problem age, how do you let them out?
Let them out means you've let the mind out. Before that, you're holding the mind and the activities. After that, the activities have already habit. So now you let the mind go, like that, and then you discuss with them on, kind of more on a different term, rather than you just telling them, now you're invoking. You get them to think. You know, the younger kids, you can tell them, or even you do use processes to make them, you know, critical thinking skills. You know, the whole process is over in about, you know, a few seconds, you know. But then when they're in the teenage, then you kind of have to take them through more, you know, explain, okay, now they're doing, but now they're kind of wondering why they're doing or values of that. So now you start to bring that out. But they can do it. They have no problem doing it. You know, no problem doing it. You know, they know they know theoretically what's the standard. Now it's like trying to start making their own intrinsic values, you know. Like that. And then that has to be worked on a lot before they hit 16. Because 16, then they're adult. Then at that time, then it's like totally they're going to make their own decisions. So if you've got in the habit before 12, you've gotten in all the technical reasonings and practical applications behind everything they do before they're 16, then at 16, that crossing there is quite easy for them. Otherwise, then that's even a more crazy time for them, because then they're trying to figure out who they are in the big world, you know. Before that, you know, they're just one of the kids. But when they hit 16, now they don't identify with the kids where they identify with the adults. A 16-year-old sees someone up to the, you know, age of like 25, 28 is an equal, just on their own, naturally. You know, unless there's some relationships established otherwise as a teacher, older brother, like that. But otherwise, to them, they don't see so much difference like that. So things already have to be very nicely established before then, so they behave properly. So it's not restriction, it's training. Because the world means restriction. You know, I mean, even we want to be as liberal as we can, we still can't drive down the wrong side of the street. We still can't go into a store and just walk off of things. We still have to follow rules, you know, like that. You know, even the most liberal person won't appreciate if just some people that they don't know just suddenly knock on the door, walk in, and just take over the house and live in it as they like, you know. It just won't be considered proper, you know. So restriction is there, but just whatever restriction you have accepted, basically, you know, consciously from 12 to 18, that's the restrictions that you will live with the rest of your life, right? You'll find devotees, they're in their 40s, 50s. Now, when they talk about, you know, kids should do this or kids should do that, or in the life it should be like this, or grihastha ashram or relationships, if you look at what they say, you can take it right back to whatever was the contemporary thing happening in the material world when they were between 12 and 18. Guaranteed. Even the language they use, slangs they use, songs they think of. You know, when devotees quote songs, you know, rock songs in their class, they're not quoting, you know, the latest thing, you know. They're quoting some back from the 60s, and, you know, some from the 50s. like that. They're not. So that sets your life. That's what you are. That's your culture. So therefore, you already have to have the subconscious and the habit done before they hit 12. Then you do the conscious work from 12 to 18. Like that. That's the system, you know. Because we may say whatever we like means everyone's entitled to their opinion. But if you look at it, that's the way it is. I mean, it's very obvious. Someone was telling me in England, you go to England, and whatever was the thing that they grew up in, they're still like that. You know, you still have, you know, well, now they must be older. Some devotee told me this back in the 80s, mid-80s. He says you have 50-year-old mods. They still dress mod and have the mod hairstyles and that. And then, you know, you have the beats before that, and they're walking around with their shades and their berets and other things like that, and little goatees. And then after that, you have your hippies. And then it's just whatever they were, they get stuck in that. It's like a time warp. And they just do that their whole life, you know? Like that. It's somehow or another, because you have England, you have your thing of traditions. So they get into that, and that's their tradition. Well, in America, it's always changing, so then it doesn't last so much. But you see subconsciously, it is. You know, even though they're in their three-piece suit on Wall Street, they still how they deal with things and that are still kind of like hippies. You know, that's why Prabhupada in his books always refers to hippies. You go, well, hippies were gone years ago, but that's what you turn back into. You know.
Maharaj, this analogy, this what you have described about the children, that analogy as timing, that can be used also for devotee training and adults training, that first the habits, they have to...
Yeah, the same thing, though you'll find that the time is quicker. Mm-hmm. Generally you'll find it's like you have about 3 years, 3 to 4, really clever to, that's what you have to kind of like... get in your basics and all that, because about when they're 3 or 4 years in the movement, that's when their critical thinking skills turn from themselves to others, and that's when they start to become nasty, political, and criticizing everybody else and all that. You know, it's their God-given right and all these kind of things. That's why in the process is bhajana kriya, all your practices, your association with devotees is all there. Then, by that time, then you hit anartha nivritti. So devotees have to be trained in the process of anartha nivritti so that they know how to keep the critical eye on themselves and keep it off of others, right? In other words, once they get down, okay, after generally you find after 3-4 years following the four regular principles and chanting your 16 rounds, comes fairly easily, you know, fairly naturally. So now it's like, okay, now I'm a devotee, I can dukes it out with the best of them. No, now you have to go for the second cleaning. That's the example that is given of Lord Chaitanya cleaning the Gundicha Marjan. Is that when he cleaned the Gundicha Mandir, is the first cleaning is all the stones and sticks and big clods of dirt and rocks and all that, and probably compares that to the four regular principles. And then he goes back and gets into the fine. That's getting out all the fine anarthas within the heart. So that's the process. And generally, that's not a well-recognized phenomena. So just in the same way as devotees don't recognize this, oh yeah, we taught all the kids little things and all this and that. And then they can't figure out why they go nuts when they become teenagers. In the same way as, oh, we taught them everything. They went through the 2-month bhakti program. And then after 3 years, when they start becoming very independent and you know, political and nasty and that, they can't figure out what went wrong. They must be insincere. You know? And that's all. And then, you know, you boot them out. But the whole point is that's the same lack of training in the Western culture that therefore they can't understand the devotional process. You know, because it's just the way things work, you know, just like in teaching. Teaching is the same way. You first give all the instructions. It means whatever must be taught in that time. So means so all your details, your anything to memorize, any definitions, any concepts, that must all be learned in the first stage by hearing from authority. Then the second stage is that they must, then you must contemplate and seriously practice. Before they're practicing, but now it must be seriously practicing because now it's conscious practice. Before it was unconscious practice. They told to do it, they did it. Second stage is conscious practice and conscious contemplation of why they're doing the things and what's the use, applications and all that. Then the third stage is they must realize and make it their own life. So we see that's just how teaching goes, the whole process. And then they must teach others. So then in the age, we see that you know, from like zero up to puberty is the time of mainly of just hearing, up to 12. Because up to 12, the memory is very great. After 12, the memory starts to go down. A touch. It goes down. And then it goes down again at around 18. But before that, you know, it's like a bear trap. Whatever you put into it, it's there. It doesn't go away. So then that's what's recommended that one does. So then from 12 to 18 you have to, or however far you can get them to do. Then the emphasis must be on the conscious practice and conscious understanding of what's going on. Then when they hit 16. Then it will turn into values. Otherwise, there's a chance it won't turn into values. You know, you see all these nice kids going through the Gurukul, and they were so saintly and wonderful, and they hit 16, and they just wig out, and that's it. You know, they just go off into the ozone. Right? That's because it didn't become their values. Because it has to be explained. See, that's the problem, is little kids, they do things properly. So you don't think you have to explain anything. But that's the time you have to explain. It's much easier to explain how to behave properly to someone who behaves properly, right? Just like you talk about the importance of religion, a religious person will agree with that, an irreligious person won't. Mm-hmm. Or someone who is into regulation and doing things on time and that, you talk that and they'll agree, yes, this is very important. You know, or someone who's into, you know, health and nutrition and all that, and you talk about the importance of that, and they'll say yes. So therefore, the little kid, they're behaving nicely and gently. This is the time to talk about those things and train them in those things seriously, because they'll take it. When they hit teenage, they don't want to hear anything about that. If they haven't been trained up to that time, who wants to hear? There's much more important things to do, like, you know, the girl next door. You know, I mean, there's a lot more happening. You know? So, like that is just the way it goes. So same in when a devotee comes, there's some time when it's everything's new for them. So they're very much just learning and absorbing whatever they hear, whatever they're taught, they'll do. Like that. Then once they come to the point where you find that doesn't go in as much, they start to more questioning is coming on, and you know, doubts and misgivings, all these things are coming up. Now that's the time to train them how to get rid of those. Then, once that kind of goes, then they become fixed, and it all becomes very much their values. Like that. Otherwise, you see everyone in the first few years are practicing very nicely, then you wonder what went wrong. Because when they come to the second stage, if they didn't take it as values, then it won't function so nicely. They'll go on. But then when it comes to the next stage, then they have to really make their decision. Then you see some devotees, they make a different decision and they disappear, or they completely change their direction, you know.
Is there a
right chance? So then when they come to that and they make it and it's theirs, and this is the way they're going to behave, this is their lifestyle, and you know, anyone else follows it or not, they couldn't care, you know, couldn't care less. So then they go to the fourth stage. Then they become very wonderful teachers and preachers. I mean, all along we're preaching, but then they become really serious, dynamic leaders. So that was the Vedic understanding. So it works with kids, it works with adults, it works with the process of training. It's just the way human psychology is. You know? So that's recognized by the Vedic culture, and therefore they follow it that way. You know, why why go against something that's so naturally there? You know, others have tried it. You know, what's the result?
Maharaj, is there a general, sort of say, general recipe on how to take out all those things that are coming up after the first stage, between the first and the second stage? You mentioned that this is when we have to teach them how to get rid of.
Yeah, so our scriptures are for that. It means that's when all the, why we follow all the different culture and etiquette, how the philosophy connects to that, the importance of it, what the good results are from following, what the bad results are from not following it. Mm-hmm. You know, it means all that kind of like contemplation must be there. And that's what Istogosti is for. I remember a new bhakta, Istogosti meant on Ekadasi you got out the nectar of devotion and they'd read through different points that are there and discuss it, and everyone would say different things and their realizations and understandings, you know, especially the any senior devotees that were there. But that was Istogosti, and then somehow or another with time, Istogosti meant the president wanted to, you know, explain some managerial points or the new quota on the Sankirtan or, you know, how these devotees are in Maya or like that. And that was, it was just pure management or even just sometimes just administration like that. So then, you know, it's just kind of like devotees lost interest. But Istogosti means you get together, an association to discuss the Lord, you know, Isha. Or Ista, is your Ista Dev, your worshipable Lord. So Istogosti means you get together to discuss about the Lord. So that means it would be topics of Sambandhavideya Prayojana. You may touch on managerial points, because at some point the philosophy has to become practical. But if it's only that without the philosophy, then it doesn't work. Then it's sentiment. And then how long can anyone go on sentiment? It means rules without philosophy is sentiment. Like that. So there, you must be able to philosophically connect. So that's what that whole middle stage is for. Then the third stage means you accept that as your own. Then one becomes qualified to teach very nicely. You know, so the study of nectar devotion, the study of any of Prabhupada's books is serious. In other words, before that's more reading, discussion, putting in the points and this and that. And also your studies, but now it's again to study it to see how it practically applies in your own life. And especially in the way of things that are wrong in the devotional creeper. You know, like that. You know, like Kapila Muni is talking about the different aspects, the Bhagavad Gita talking about, you know, the 11th canto, the Uddhava Gita. You know, Bhagavad Gita, Uddhava Gita, and Kapila's teachings to his mother. These all give very fundamental nectar devotion, Upadeshamrita, you know, like this. They get into just how one is behaving and how one relates to others, the material nature, worships the Lord, the whole thing. So these have to be very nicely understood, you know. The first time you're teaching it, they're just getting familiar with it. But their ability to use it and understand won't be so great. But the second time when you go through, then they can go through deeply. Then it's like how this applies in our life, how it applies in our own heart. Like that. That's very, very important. And that's basically what's been neglected. That's when Prabhupada says, boil the milk. That's what's happening. We've got the milk, but now it should be boiled. You know, it becomes condensed. It becomes sweet when it's condensed. Otherwise, it's milk, nice. Volume is there, but condense it. So it's not, they've learned the books, they've learned how to do Sankirtan, they've learned how to associate devotees. Now let's get into a really deep study and cook things down and raise the standards. You know? Then it becomes another platform. You know, and Prabhupada was talking about that when the temples were like squeaky clean, you know, you could eat off the floors, the temples were so clean and their fragrance was so nice. All you could smell in the temple was ghee and incense, because the place was so clean, no other smells would be there. You know, this is back when they knew how to cook properly, the Indian style of cooking Prabhupada talked about, like that. You know? So, you know, when all these kind of cultural things were still present, that, and Prabhupada's saying, now refine it, boil it down, increase the quality, you know? So, if you don't go that, it'll just go the other way. Because then devotees have doubts and misgivings, then they don't know why to follow it. Then they start even doubting the authority. You know? And then, or even the principle of authority. And then how they'll function, how they'll work. Does that make any sense?
You were describing it before the age of 12, basically, the children are given things to do, you know, like they don't have any choice, they're just doing it.
Yeah.
And then as they, then they develop habits from that, and then at a later age, after 12, and they start to discuss about why they're doing it. Some parents say that, oh, when my child was younger, I took him to Mangalati and I made him sit through Bhagavatam class, and now he's a teenager, he doesn't want to do any of these things, and I think it's because I forced it down his throat when he was younger. So is there any truth in this concept?
Well, you'd have to look at two things. One is when we say that by authority you establish it, means that it has to be established in such a way that the child accepts it and does it. If the parents are doing it, generally most children do what their parents do. So then there must, you know, one has to see is, you know, why that wouldn't have gotten across. Why is the parents doing it then? They really like going to Mangalarti, or they just think they have to go? You know? And then why do they have to go? Can they explain it themselves? That's it. So maybe the parents' convictions weren't strong enough, therefore the children didn't pick them up. You know, it wasn't natural on the parents' part. You know, they were only going because the kid was there and they figured they should set good example, but if the kid wasn't there, they'd sleep in. Then you might have the problem. If the parents go, then that's nice. But it's not that you're not explaining it, but how much can the younger kids understand? So they understand up to their level, but it's not that deep. As I mentioned before, in the beginning, when you start the critical thinking process in a little kid, you know, it's over in a matter of seconds, basically. You know, you can take them through a few steps, very basic steps, and then, you know, they've gotten to as much understanding as really they can get, you know, and then they go back to just being cute, you know, like that. So that's explained anyway. But what is being explained must be also done in connection with good habits. Was it ever explained that, yes, good brahmacharis go to Mangalarti, and good devotees, and because we're going to become good devotees, we're not good brahmacharis, then we're not going to be able to move in the world nicely. Just fundamental little things. Was that explained to them? You know? Second thing is that they say, well, they're shoved down their throat, and so now they're going crazy. What is this age that they're saying this? Are they saying this at 12, 13? Or are they saying this at 16, 18, 20? Because if they're saying this at 16, 8, above 16, that means the time of the really bringing out the critical thinking wasn't done. If they're saying it at 13, that's another thing. Then it means that just the basics, how they didn't really get the basics into their head. You know, by either good example or, you know, nice explanation. And if they're older, then they may have done that, but then they didn't go to the second stage. They just somehow or another thought the third stage would happen automatically. No, the third will happen very nicely if the second stage and the first stage are done very well. Then it's kind of like the third and the fourth stage will happen automatically. But the emphasis has to be on the first two, with the goal of the third and the fourth. It means the reason that we're giving them the basic teaching, the reason that we're trying to get them to practice and understand, is so that they will value it and they will teach that to the next generation. Like that. So any activity must have relationship, process, and goal. You know, so if the goal was just get them to Mangalarti, then it's natural, then, you know, they've already attained it, you know. But if the goal is something bigger, then they understand Mangalarti is part of a bigger picture, then it can be done. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
So they just have to see, was their goal, the process they followed, was it nice? You know? Like that. So you have to see. And then you always have the chances, parent may have done all that right, and then it doesn't work right, and that's just, you just maybe a bad kid. It's nothing to do with the process, just like Venu's father. He was a good, dutiful king. He just had a bad news son. So that aspect is there, because the living entity, you don't really know who you're getting. You know, it's you know, it's a, you know, at least in the modern concept, it's pretty much, it's complete gamble. The Vedic concept, it's a what do you call it, educated guess. But in, huh? Yeah, so the educated guess, you have a pretty good idea, because you have an idea of what kind of child you want, and according to proper mentality, then one attempts to gain that particular child. You know, but who the soul is, what their past activities and karma and all this, one can't, ultimately doesn't know. Parents do their best. You know, so that's there. So if they did everything and it still didn't work, Then it just may be a bad kid, you know, or there's other influences around, you know, like that.
And that brings me on to another point. Then it seems when a child, or a boy particularly, is above 5, up until say 10 or so, then he identifies a lot with his father. I mean, that
a little bit, but there's still a lot with the mother.
And the mother, but then from the time beyond that, they seem to identify more with someone outside the family, like older peers, or it could be, you know, an older man. And
No, that's there. But if it's done nicely, then the relationship with the father is very strong. But it's harder for the father to deal, though he can relate many times better than the mother. But it's recommended that they go to a teacher. Because that's the whole idea, is that the consciousness goes outside, like that. Because that's the point of life, what it's for. It's for contemplating what's going out in the world. It's not for looking at the house. You know, that is the time when they should be observative of the world and understand how the modes of nature work, how the different, you know, elements work, how all the relationships work, rather than just, you know, I do this and then the girls are happy with me, I do that and they're not. You know, it's supposed to be something a little higher than that. So the whole idea is that they're in the home up to a certain point, and then they go to the school, and the school has them at a point where they can still relate to them. Below a certain point, they must be with the original parents, as it's pointed out. But after that point, then they have to be with other parents. The teacher is also a parent. You know, a good teacher means they can deal in the parental rasa. So they can do something. Because if the parents say, well, I can't get into that, I don't like the school, then they have to understand, well, the teachers of their kids are going to be their peers. And the peers are outside the house. And what they're doing, you know, God only knows. You know? Like that. So they can say what they like, but after that certain age, they can't keep them in the house all day. There's no interest in the house. Therefore, going out out of the house into what's outside, they're already out. So then you can deal with that, you know? So that's why the Gurukul was there. And we see with the girls, that's when they would go out and live with their husband. They would go from their father's house to the husband's house. So the girl's taken care of in that way. The boy is done to the same thing, but he went through by going out to the Gurukul. Like that. So they're going to go somewhere else and be trained by someone else. So that's the whole point, is they're done. It's the same thing as there, though the application is different from the boys and girls. The same principles there. Does that make? Because otherwise they're going to go out, you know, But yeah. Then how they go out and what they do while they're out, then that's not necessarily...
They're going to be looking for someone other than their father to kind of look up to. So consciously in the Vedic system, they provide that person with information.
Yeah.
Teacher.
Yeah. That was the whole idea. Like that. And other members of the community.
Mm.
You know? Like that.
That brings me to another point, which is rites of passage. What importance do they have in a boy's life?
Right, that's very important. Though some scars are highly recommended. Prabhupada talks about them again and again and again. Because the point is one isn't making really serious commitment until, you know, much older in life. Before that, one is committing, but, you know, it can be easily changed by association and other things very easily. But generally when one's a little older, you know, especially 16 and above, then it's like the commitments are very strong. Though they can be made at much younger. We see Prahlad was made such commitments at 5. So in the Krishna conscious platform it can be done. But otherwise it just comes very naturally, you know, really solid at that time. So before that, then so much assistance is there in the way of samskaras. And the devotional activities that are there that are just going to create the purity in which the proper decision can be made. Therefore, all these different things are there. You know, I just heard another interesting thing this morning, just the preparation. The child in the womb, what they hear in the womb very much affects their consciousness when they're after they're born. So if all they're hearing is temple programs and reading of Bhagavatam and all these kind of nice things, then when they get out, that's what they're going to be like. You know, but while they're there, then they hear all kinds of crazy music and the television running and, you know, staying at their, you know, in some other place with no devotees, and then the husband and wife are criticizing devotees or yelling and screaming at each other. Because the rule is the husband and wife can't argue in front of the children. So when the child's in the womb, he's still present. You know, but the Western thing is, you know, they don't consider that. You know, therefore, you can have things such as abortion. Because, you know, they don't mean anything till they're born. But the Vedic thing is a very major birth chart is the moment of conception. Like that. So that is taken as a very, you can see their whole life from that. So if the moment of conception is auspicious, you can do the chart at the time of birth, but it will always be in an auspicious time. One astrologer mentioned that. He says, someone who's conceived in an auspicious time will always be born in an auspicious time. Because their life started then. So then the whole rest will be auspicious. So the time will be auspicious. Like that. Someone born in an inauspicious, conceived in an inauspicious time will be born in an inauspicious time. Like that. So all these different things have to be considered, you know, what was doing like this, you know. You know, like what was the, you know, parents doing? Especially if the, you know, one has to be very careful. All these different things are there. So all these different aspects, they have great effect on the child. Like that. So the Vedic system is very careful about these things. Like that. Yes.
Well, Ayurveda states, I was reading that Dr. Basant Lad, he said, in the fifth month of pregnancy, if the husband and wife argue, this can actually cause serious heart defects.
To the child.
To the child. And you get this hole in the heart, these other complications.
Well.
Especially from arguments in the fifth month onwards. And at that time, couples should take great care to make sure that this never takes place, because if it does, there's a very good chance of a serious heart.
Hmm, that's interesting. We see in Kapila's father, then he had already kind of like worked out all basics with Devahuti before conceiving his children. You know, he already saw that the relationship was tight enough that they could work very well together with no problems. Once that's done, then they can see the child. Otherwise, if they still have things to work out, then they wouldn't, you know, like that. Because, you know, as Prajapatis, they know the science of having children. You know, so when it comes to that, we should learn from them. They know what they're doing. Others may or may not know what they're doing. That's very, very interesting. That was from which place?
Dr. Vasant Rai, who wrote Ayurveda, the science of self-healing.
Okay. So then he must be taking out of the big books.
Mm.
Okay. We have that book. Huh? Mm. Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. Because Ayurveda mentions in the Mahabharata, I think it says, the Veda, the Ayurveda, I think the philosophy, I'm not sure if he mentioned one other thing, says these can never be challenged. These scriptures could never be doubted or challenged. Just absolutely, you know, you want to doubt something else. Don't doubt these. The Mahabharata mentions, just you can't doubt these ones. This is just the way it is, you know. These things are just how it functions. You just don't doubt them. Yes.
This verse explained those Brihadvrata and this other one, which I don't remember what the name was. And we see that nowadays, many times, Brahmacharis, they kind of don't make decisions like that. They kind of live it
day to day.
Yes. Yeah, so
live the life day to day.
Yeah, like, you know.
Nothing walks along too interesting, and they just continue. And something overly interesting walks by, then suddenly they go to the president. You know, I was thinking I should. Time to become more responsible. Yeah, but they have to be trained in what it is. What is the commitment? What is the decision? And, you know, what is actually there? What are they functioning with? The realities of just of brahmachari life and what it means. What it means to be a naishtika and what it means to be an upakurvana. Both must be described. Otherwise, it's not. It's neglect on the part of the temple authorities or the congregational authority, whatever situation they're in, community authorities. If they haven't been trained in actually what it means to be a brahmachari, grihasthas haven't been trained what it means to be grihastha, because that's what it's for. That's why they're leaders, to train them in these things. And if they feel they're unqualified to do that, but they're good organizers, good managers, then they should manage, and then someone who can do that then should be very prominent in the whole process. And there should be a tight cooperation between them. Between the manager and the person who can train. Like that. Okay. Yes.
A different point is that in the purport, Prabhupada mentions about men and women mixing and speaking as equals.
Hmm.
What does that mean?
See, equals, it's a fine point. Is when they move and speak as equals, because you'll see is the nature of men and women are different. Men are more expert in some areas, women in others, you know, physically certain aspects are superior in one and certain aspects in another. So if you look at it, there's no equality, actually, between men and women. There's always a difference in different spheres, different things. So there's no real equality there. The only time that there is equality, where it's purely 50-50, is conceiving a child. Because it takes both. Like that. So therefore, when you create an environment when there's complete equality, it enhances the atmosphere of you know, the sexual mood and innuendos. And that whole scene comes up. Therefore, in the Vedic system, they always kept it that it was either the woman is more respectable or is daughter. They're either mother or daughter. And only with wife, then it would be equal. And even in that, then the husband is the guru. So there's a little bit of difference, you know. And then when he gets off, then she's the Dharmapatni, and then she's above. So only when they want to conceive a child is there complete equalness. So the Vedic culture is very, understanding this principle is very careful. Because you see, if you run it too close, you know, this contemporary example is going on now. Just they work too close together and too equally, then there's, you know, there's fall down. It just happens because that's the modes, the way they work. So when there's respect, see, when there's respect, there's control of the senses. So if a man and a woman that shouldn't be getting together do, that means there's a lack of respect. It won't be looked like that. It'll say it's love or this or that or attraction or, but it's let's say mutual attraction, yes, but it's also mutual disrespect. Because the man is not respecting the woman as an individual, and he's becoming attracted by her body, and she the same way. So therefore, it's especially if it's a situation that shouldn't be happening like that, you know. So it's just, you know, the whole process is exploitation. Here it's being presented in a very nice light, and it's generally spoken of that way. But now and again, it's like the whole, how you say, bewildering little shimmering light above it is removed, and then it's hard reality is just brought forward. But sense gratification means exploitation, that's all. So it's just that the husband and wife mutually agree to allow each other to exploit their body, that's all. It's a mutual agreement. If there's not a mutual agreement, then you don't feel bad, that's the point. You know, I don't feel happy that this person would get too close to me, right? And I wouldn't want to get very close to that person. So when it's each one would like to get I would like to get close to them and don't mind them getting close like this, then you have a match. But the underlying principle is the exploitation. The living entity in the mood of Purusha is a male, wants to exploit the prakriti, or the body and the facilities that go with the body. You know, so that's the more stark reality of it. You know, which is brought out every now and again to kind of put things into light. But if you want to discuss the culture and the whole things, then you leave that one aside. You know, if you just want to establish the souls different from the body and those the transcendental, then this is brought out. But if not, then you don't so much. You talk about the cooperation more and all these different things. So the reality is that's what's going on, is the exploitation. You know, the man is exploiting all the, you know, fine qualities that the woman has, and that pleases him. And the woman is exploiting all the, you know, different aspects that the man will provide, you know, in the whole institution of marriage, like that. So it's, the whole thing's exploitive. But in the if one follows the Dharma and that is engaged in the Lord's service, for pleasing Krishna, one follows the Dharma, and then it becomes devotional service. Because we must deal with the material energy anyway. But now it's not exploitive. That's the point. It's not exploitive. So the combination of man and woman can very easily turn exploitive. Therefore, it's restricted very much. But like women, like here it says, when it says one should not associate with women, that means men. Women have no problem associating with women because there's no exploitive nature there. So with them, women associating with women is not bad association. Like that. But for the man it is, because they can turn into that exploitive mood. And they can become attracted by, you know, the lower levels of sense gratification. Therefore, it's very carefully dealt with. Very carefully dealt with. Just to avoid that. Because the whole idea is that the relationship should be established on the emotional platform, not on the sensual. So then that requires that the sensual is kept very much controlled. Then the deeper exchange of the emotions is experienced. Otherwise, then one will get the exchange of the senses, but one, the relationships will be very shallow. Right? Because to engage in sense gratification, you don't have to even know who the other person is at all. Right? You don't have to know at all.
Just criticize this concept of binding, sister.
Binding, yeah. sister. It's not sister, it's mother.
Equal.
It's mother. Like that. So therefore that respectfulness must be there. But that has to be understood in its social respect and proper dealings and gentle dealings. It doesn't mean managerial respect. This is very important. This is where generally it breaks down in the West, because they're uncomfortable respecting the women, because then, let's say, if the president respects the women, then they start telling him what to do, how to run his temple. Therefore, he doesn't. But if he can just respect them and deal with them properly and see that they're to have whatever they need to do their service, that's there, and they don't get involved in the managerial, then it makes life a lot easier. But the Western culture is so geared in that way, you know, controlling the men and the money, that, you know, so that goes on, that goes on in the house, but in the temple thing it can't. You know, so then it just, the whole thing breaks down. The brahmacharis don't get trained, so they deal very roughly with the women. The managers deal roughly, you know, like that. So then there's a problem. You know, there's a problem. They have to be respected as mother. Like that. Or if the age difference or the relationship, they can be respected as daughter. But they always respect. That's why the girl is dressed very, very nicely with nice cloth and ornaments and that, and, you know, given dowries by the father. That's out of respect to the daughter. You know, means it says that Manasapita, the father respects the daughter in that way. So if he's wealthy, then they go with dowry. If not, you know, just at least nice cloth and ornaments. Doesn't have that, then whatever he can do, but respect is there. You know? So the basic thing of the Vedic culture, the bottom line is that respect, and then from that, then they can turn into affection. Right? But it has to start with respect. The husband has to respect the proper training and dharmic nature of the wife, and she has to respect the position of the husband. Like that, then the whole thing works, you know? And it works very, very nicely. You know, even Prabhupada's talking about the spiritual master. He's seeing the disciples as representing his own spiritual master. His own spiritual master sent him disciples so that he can be always talking about the instructions he's heard from his guru and setting that example, and then trying to get them to do. So in other words, the disciples ensure that the spiritual master follows the teachings and example of his own spiritual master. So therefore he sees like that. So it's his service to the spiritual master, it's his service to these living entities to train them. So then you have, it's based on an underlying thing of respect. Though in the dealings, then the teacher will be the superior and the disciple would be the junior, but it doesn't mean how the whole is based on isn't respect, isn't a mutual respect. So the point is you have all these seemingly contradictory subtle points. So that's human life, right? If non-human life doesn't bother with the subtleties. You know, human life deals with the subtleties. So that's the whole idea, is the devotional process and all that must develop the subtleties, the fineness. And all the different aspects of dress and all this too. Genes don't develop much fineness, right? Because genes were developed by people who herded cows for slaughter. So it's naturally not going to have the finest application. It's not going to invoke the finest aspects from the personality. But we see dhotis and chadars and saris in that. To wear them takes a certain fineness, you know? You have to be conscious with that.
I can see that the respect which is given to a guru is on the basis basis that he has knowledge and he's sharing that knowledge? On what basis is the respect shown to women as a mother?
Because women by nature have that motherly attitude. They're somebody's mother, or they're potentially somebody's mother. It may not be your mother, but they're somebody's mother, or they have the potential to become a mother. So the potency of mother, of nourishment, is they're endowed with that. Just as they're endowed with, which is in the next, I think, yeah, the next verse, which will come up, is they're imbued with the quality of fire. So that also must be respected. They're very powerful in that way. You know, you have, you know, great sages and personalities are just brought down by the fire of a woman. Like that. They have so much knowledge, you know. Vishwamitra. You know, so many personalities. That was what was unique. Markandeya. There's, you know, Indra saw him doing penances and austerities, and generally when they see people doing that, that means that they want power and all that, and then they're going to come after Indra. So then he just naturally, in his jealousy and all these kind of things, then he, you know, because of his attachment, over attachment to women, like that. When you go to the demigods above Indra, Indra's the top of the line of those who are attached to sense gratification. Above him, then they're not attached. They don't deal and function on that platform. You know? At least they're not supposed to. Now and again, you know, they have problems, but not as a general. Well, he has a general. So then he sent, you know, all his, you know, best apsaras and Cupid himself and everything like this, and then they did a whole number. He's just sitting in the forest doing his meditation, and suddenly spring personified changes the whole place and makes it wonderful, and the Gandharvas are singing, and the apsaras are dancing. And the whole place is just, you know, really, really wonderful. And then, just at that moment, then when I'm not sure if he even opened his eyes or something, when everything was like perfect and suitable and Cupid is, you know, satisfied that the arrangements are wonderful, then he shoots his you know, flower arrow at him and then finds out that nothing happened. And then it's kind of like Cupid starts to go, uh-oh. You know, let's get out of here before we get burned to ashes, you know, and all that. And that Markandeya was, you know, such a person that he didn't. Because otherwise, he got burnt to ashes by Lord Shiva. That's why he's called Ananga. He has no body. Like that, because he came and started to agitate Lord Shiva, and so he just looked at him and burned him to ashes. You know. So that power that has to be respected. So therefore one keeps one's respectful distance. At the same time as if one has to deal, one deals as mother. You know? Because the result of that fire is motherhood. Right? So that has to be respected. You know? Because Shakti means energy, fire. That, so that's respected. Same time as the women also have responsibility for it. Just like a king is powerful, he has to take responsibility, use that power properly. And if he misuses it, he is responsible. So the woman also has that power. So she also has to be very conscious not to use it. And if she uses it, she's responsible. She's responsible. You know, it's not just do whatever you like to do. No, there's a responsibility there. A great responsibility. Okay. I think we'll end here. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Ooh. Purport, Prabhupada says, the purport of the next verse is this. If one cannot understand the basic principle of restraining association between man and woman, he is to be considered an animal. This is the verse. Woman is compared to fire, man is compared to butter, a better butter pot. Therefore, a man should avoid associating even with his own daughter in a secluded place. Similarly, he should also avoid associating with other women. One should associate with women only for important business and not otherwise. That's the conclusion of this section. I think then they go on. Jai Ho. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.